I'd like to start by thanking Bloomberg for hosting this event and Rebecca for her kind introduction. Today I'll be speaking about the future system for monetary policy implementation. That is, that's the method by which the Reserve Bank of Australia controls the cash rate. Planning for the future system is important given that the unwinding of unconventional monetary policies is leading to a decline in exchange settlement balances, otherwise known as reserves. Reserves held by banks in their ES accounts at the RBA play a central role in policy implementation. Banks use these funds, they use them to settle payments with other banks, they use it to also settle with the RBA, and they can lend these surplus funds, if they have them, to other banks in the overnight cash market. And it's those transactions that go into the determination of the cash rate. At its recent meeting in March, the Reserve Bank Board considered three options for the future system of the implementation of monetary policy. So the first, maintain what we currently have, which is a floor system with an excess of reserves. The second is a return to a corridor system with scarce reserves. So that's what we used prior to the pandemic. And the third option is a transition to a new system of ample reserves that lies somewhere between these two. So the board endorsed a plan to move to this third option, ample reserves, with a full allotment repurchase agreement auctions for open market operations. The Bank of England, that's the European Central Bank, and the Swedish Riksbank, they've all announced they'll be operating similar systems. So I want to just start, though, by emphasising that this decision has no implications whatsoever for the current or the future stance for monetary policy. Rather, it's only relevant to the way in which we achieve the desired stance of monetary policy through our operations. Nor does it have a bearing on the board's current approach to quantitative tightening, which is to allow bonds purchased during the pandemic to run down as they mature and to periodically review the case to actively sell bonds. So today what I'm going to do is explain the three options for policy implementation, discuss some of the reasons why the board has chosen to pursue the ample reserve system, and lay out some of the next steps as we move towards that approach. So as I said, the first option is to stay with the current approach, what we're doing now. So that's an excess supply of reserves that leads the cash rate to be close to a floor. And that's the floor that is the rate that we pay to banks on funds that they leave overnight in their ES accounts, otherwise known as the ES rate. The shift to this approach from the earlier system of scarce reserves began back in mid-March 2020. So back then, there were growing concerns about the economic effects of the pandemic, and that led to considerable stresses in global financial systems, including in Australia. And as a first response, the RBA increased the extent of liquidity we were providing to banks. So that was the very first thing we did. Settlement balances, as you can see here, quickly ramped up as the RBA met additional demand at our daily open market operations. We bought government bonds also in support of functioning of those markets. And then reserves grew further with the advent of the Term Funding Facility, which came just a little bit later. And then later still with bond purchases in support of the yield target and the bond purchase program in later 2020. So as ES balances rose to very high levels and the initial financial market stresses eased, most banks found that they had quite a surplus of funds in their accounts with us, their ES accounts. So the demand for banks to borrow from one another in the cash market, that fell away. They didn't need that to meet their payments and other needs. As a result, the cash rate became very closely anchored to this floor, the ES rate, and activity in the cash market fell away markedly. ES balances stabilised around $460 billion, so quite a lot higher than they had been prior to the pandemic. They stabilised at that level around 2020, following the end of the bond purchase program. And then since about February of last year, they've been declining as some of the bonds held by the bank have matured, and the first tranche of the TFF was repaid last September. ES balances are going to decline further, as we've sort of suggested in my earlier chart, when the remaining $96 billion of the TFF, that's required to be repaid by the middle of this year by the banks, and as the RBA's bond portfolio continues to decline. So we're confident that the very high level of ES balances right now is still well in excess of what the banking system as a whole needs to satisfy what I'm going to describe as underlying demand. That is, what they need to meet their payment and their minimum liquidity needs. But as ES balances decline further, there's going to come a point where reserves are no longer in excess of underlying demand. So some central banks have decided to retain the current systems that many of us have, excess reserves, in order to ensure that reserves remain in excess of underlying demand. At some point, those central banks are going to need to offset declines in reserves associated with the unwinding of their unconventional policies. So they can do this in a number of ways, but in general, what they're going to have to do is buy assets, such as government bonds or possibly foreign exchange transactions. So these central banks will work to maintain a buffer of reserves over and above the underlying demand. And if that buffer isn't sufficient, it could lead to volatility in a range of money markets. In order to avoid that possibility, the central banks in question will be monitoring conditions very closely in money markets and responding if they need to, noting that demand can change over time and sometimes can move very quickly. But the board's decided not to maintain the current system, the current floor system with excess reserves. And one reason for that is it would require the bank, the RBA, to hold a sizable buffer of reserves over underlying demand, and that would necessitate a relatively large balance sheet on an ongoing basis. Compared with the other options, this implies some additional risk to the RBA, such as interest rate risk, and a more sizable footprint in markets. So what about the option of just going back to where we were before, to our earlier system of scarce reserves, to guide the cash rate to target? So that system was in use for many, many years before March 2020. What it entails is the central bank supplying just enough reserves to meet this underlying demand of the banking system, and then we provide standing facilities to ensure that the policy rate trades in what's called a corridor around the target. So in Australia, banks with surplus reserves, in the past they could leave them on deposit with the RBA at the ES rate, which used to be 25 basis points below the cash rate target. And banks with a shortage of reserves, if they needed to, could borrow them overnight from the RBA at 25 basis points above the target. So that gave you a 50 basis point corridor. Banks had no reason to pay a rate above the top of the corridor, cheaper to borrow from us. And nor would they lend reserves at a rate below the floor of the corridor. They just leave them in their account with us and get a better rate. But to keep the cash rate near the target, the RBA needed to very accurately estimate the demand for reserves, forecast changes in the supply of reserves, and conduct its open market operations daily. The system worked very well for many years, with the cash rate almost always at the target. Compared with the other two options, this system does have a couple of attractive features because it entails a smaller balance sheet than under excess or ample reserves. It naturally implies lower interest rate risk for the bank. Similarly, it implies a smaller footprint of the RBA in financial markets. Indeed, this system supports more cash market activity than the other options because on any given day, it's likely that some banks are facing a shortage of reserves and need to borrow from other banks to meet their needs under a scarce reserve system. But despite these benefits, the board's decided not to return to a scarce reserve system. Such a system entails the higher risk of banking system running into liquidity shortages. A scarce reserve system requires the central bank to have pretty accurate estimates of reserve demand and supply on a daily basis and respond quite actively to short-term fluctuations as needed. So in the past, this appeared to be very successful, with only a few trivial deviations in the cash rate from the target. In fact, you can't see any in the short history of this graph. The cash rate target in orange and the cash rate sit on top of each other in the history there. So a large part of that, though, may have been because of a convention where cash market participants almost always conducted their trades in the cash market at the target set by the board. So having moved away from that environment, there's no inherent reason why such a convention would re-emerge. Moreover, even though the cash rate in the past would trade close to target, there were lengthy periods when liquidity was tighter in broader money markets, such as repo and bank bills. This was evident when markets traded noticeably above the cash rate or the overnight index swap rate, even though the cash rate was trading at the target. And this tightening in financial conditions reflected in part the fact that some money market participants did not have access to the cash market, and they borrowed in other short-term money markets. And at the same time, banks were often reluctant to lend out large volumes of reserves in money markets until very late in the day when they were confident of their own capacity to meet their own liquidity needs. So having moved away from scarce reserves after the onset of the pandemic, the other thing is that banks appear to have adapted their operations to an environment of higher reserves, simplifying their liquidity management and facilitating smoother daily payment processes. In other words, the underlying demand for reserves is likely to have increased compared with pre-pandemic days. It's difficult to accurately estimate underlying demand in any system, but small errors of estimation would be more problematic in a system of scarce reserves, since they can lead to considerable volatility in cash and other money markets. Another issue is that scarce reserve systems are not resilient in the face of a sharp rise in the demand for liquidity in the banking system during occasions of considerable financial market stress, so such as occurred during the onset of the pandemic. So the RBA may be faced with such a scenario in the future, need to provide a large increase in reserves. As I said, this occurred at the onset of the pandemic when we met all reasonable demands for liquidity from participants at our open market operations, much like the way we do at our full allotment auctions, which are working currently. Reserves also increased with the RBA's purchase of bonds to address dysfunction in government bond markets at the time. For those of you who remember and were watching those markets closely, they almost all shut down, particularly the US Treasury market, the US market. So in short, scarce reserve systems are not well suited to environments where demand for reserves is volatile, where it's difficult to estimate accurately, and where the supply may change substantially depending on the need for central banks to use balance sheet policies. For all these reasons, no other advanced central bank has indicated a return to such a scarce reserve system. Right, so the third option, that's the one the board's endorsed. It's an ample reserve system in which banks' demand for reserves are satisfied via open market repo operations, but at a price that's near the cash rate target in what we call full allotment auctions. Together with the floor provided by the ES rate, these operations should keep the cash rate close to the target. Setting the price of reserves in this way is in contrast with the two alternative systems I've just described, where what you're doing is setting the quantity of reserves in order to affect the price. Under ample, you set the price and the reserves come out. Under the ample reserve system, the supply of reserves can rise and fall in line with changes in demand, with minimal effects on the cash rate and other money market rates. So the board sees a number of advantages with this new approach. Since the supply of reserves from the RBA will respond to changes in demand, we don't need to accurately estimate demand nor control the quantity of reserves. In short, it's simpler to operate than a scarce reserves or excess reserve system. An ample reserve system also reduces the risk of unnecessary volatility or disruptions to conditions in money markets. And similarly, it's more resilient to any future expansion in the RBA's balance sheet if, for example, there was a need to address extreme stresses affecting bond markets, such as we saw at the start of the pandemic. That said, in this system, banks will still need to ensure that they manage their liquidity carefully, including by obtaining sufficient liquidity at our open market operations. An ample reserve system is likely to lead to more activity in the cash market and other markets compared with an excess reserve system, although not as much as under scarce reserves. With the supply of reserves just sufficient to satisfy underlying demand, the RBA's balance sheet will be no larger than it needs to be in order to implement monetary policy, and our footprint in financial markets will be smaller than in an excess reserve system. The RBA will use repurchase agreements to supply reserves, which as of February this year are based on a floating rate, so that removes interest rate for the RBA, interest rate risk. Other operations could also be used, though, to supply reserves, so we could purchase short-dated government bonds and/or FX swaps. We used all of these types of operations prior to the pandemic, and they can also be structured in a way to minimise interest rate risk to the Reserve Bank. That's in contrast to an excess reserve system, for which it may be more difficult to supply a sufficient quantity of reserves while also limiting interest rate risk held on the bank's balance sheet and avoiding an overly large footprint in some markets. So what about the transition? Well, the RBA has been running full allotment OMO repo auctions since shortly after the onset of the pandemic. So from our counterparty's perspective, there's no immediate changes in our operations. Currently, the supply of reserves is in excess of underlying demand, as I said earlier. And what that means is that most banks have no need to obtain liquidity through open market operations. So our open market operation balance outstanding is very low compared to what it used to be prior to the pandemic. As the level of reserves falls, however, as they come back, we'll at some point transition from excess, where we are now, to an environment of ample reserves. And as that happens, what we expect is to see cash market activity increase, perhaps with some risk to a small rise in the cash rate, potentially some pressure in other money markets emerging. But by design, however, any such pressures should, to a large extent, be tempered as banks naturally respond to higher interest rates by borrowing more at OMO repo at the price set by the RBA. As always, the RBA will be monitoring conditions closely, particularly around the upcoming maturity of the TFF, which is in a few months. And we have the ability to respond to market stresses if the need arises, including by conducting OMO more frequently. Currently, they're just once a week. So what's next? Well, the board's endorsed a plan to move to an ample reserves framework with full allotment, OMO repo as the RBA's future monetary policy implementation system. The next steps are for the RBA to determine the more detailed aspects of that system, including the pricing, the frequency, and other aspects of our OMO repos, and what other instruments we might use to supply reserves. In addition to repo via full allotment auctions, the demand reserves could be accommodated via a mix of FX swaps and purchases of short-dated government bonds. Among other considerations, that's going to depend on how the RBA wants to structure its balance sheet over the medium term. Also, a range of instruments could help to avoid an overly large presence in any one market, which might otherwise crowd out private sector activity in that market. Under the earlier system of scarce reserves, all of those means of managing reserves, the repo, the FX swaps, the holding of government bonds outright, they were commonplace, though the outstanding balances for those instruments may well be greater under ample reserves. So one issue we'll be looking at closely is how banks adjust to the progressive withdrawal of liquidity implied by the rundown in reserves, hence the accessibility of reserves at OMO, and in particular the price to borrow reserves under repo. That'll be a point of interest, including because it involves some trade-offs. For example, OMO repo rate with a low spread over the ES rate, that's going to provide banks with an incentive to demand more reserves than otherwise. Now, that's good because it may facilitate a more efficient payments and reduce risk to financial stability, but it's going to reduce incentives for banks to source liquidity from private markets and give the RBA a larger footprint in markets and a larger balance sheet. Conversely, an OMO rate further above the ES rate, that's more expensive to obtain funds. The banks will provide, be provided, therefore, with an incentive to hold fewer reserves than otherwise, obtain more liquidity from private markets, including in the cash rate, in the cash market. So those are good things, but it could leave banks with smaller buffers to deal with sudden and unexpected increases in their need for reserves and result in more volatility in market money market rates. Anyway, the board's going to consider all of these issues in due course, and that's going to be aided by the results of a public consultation and a close liaison of my team members with market participants. That's going to commence shortly. In the meantime, our operations in financial markets are just going to continue as they are. So that's weekly full allotment repo operations, 28-day terms, priced at a floating rate of 5 basis points above the cash rate target. So finally, let me just stress again, and apologies, this is all about the plumbing underpinning the monetary policy system, right? It's not about the stance of monetary policy. It's not about the temperature of the water running through those pipes in the plumbing. It's just about the plumbing. So with that, I'm in Swati's hands. So thank you, Swati, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Chris. That was a very detailed speech, and I think it's going to be a document that market participants will continue to refer to in the weeks and months to come, because how central banks react to this huge liquidity, it has been a question that everybody has been trying to understand. And like you said, a lot of these are still untested as well. So I'm going to start off with some questions, and then I'll open the floor. First question is a three-part question. So you're talking about moderating the balance sheet size. Do we have an idea of how large this is going to be and by when? So two-part question.
No, we don't, is the short answer. What it will depend on is banks' underlying demand for reserves. And as I suggested in my speech, that may have changed. So in the past, they were really used to operating with very small total reserves in the system. Something in the order of $2, $3 billion was a daily outcome for the banking system. Now they've got used to a much larger balance. They might have changed their operations more persistently. That's something they'll learn, and it's something the system will have to sort of deal with. But the point of having our open market operations, which is full allotment. So what that means is the banks tell us how much they want at the fixed price. As long as they've got good collateral, they get that amount. So that means the supply of reserves, in other words, the size of our balance sheet, will be determined by that demand. We know it's less than where we are now. Mm. We can come up with some rough estimates. The banks can do their own, but we don't know exactly where it'll be. We know when we get there, when more of the banks start to show up at our auctions. At the moment, the demand, as I showed in my chart, is fairly low. When that starts to pick up, we know we're getting close.
So that is once the system kicks in, like some months after the system kicks in?
Well, the system's all ready to go, and it's just a matter of transitioning as our bonds mature, as the TFF gets repaid. The reserves will naturally come down, and we'll get to a point where the banks say, I don't have as many reserves as I would like, just sitting in my account. I'm going to need to go to the Reserve Bank and get some from their auctions. So when that happens, that's when we think we'll know we're transitioning from excess to something that's ample.
Right. Okay. And this system is largely untested globally as well, right? Like you mentioned ECB and BOE, Riksbank, they are all have also introduced it, but then there is no history. What risks do you see of this system?
I think this is going to be the best system for Australia, and I don't envisage significant risks. There's always some risk, particularly during a transition. I think the reason why I'm fairly confident here the transition will be relatively smooth is because we already have these open market operations at full allotment working. It started actually quite a bit earlier than in an informal sense. I think it was the Friday, the 16th of March, 2020, when we knew there were a lot of stresses in the financial system. So we increased at our auctions, which weren't full allotment. We said, we'll provide more, trying to calm markets down. And then banks came to us and they asked for way more than that total. And we said, okay, you can have it. So we're starting early on in that process of this sort of concept of a full allotment auction. You get what you need. But we've now got a fixed price. We've been doing this for some years. And the banks don't have hesitation in showing up if they need it. So we don't have a stigma about banks coming to that main facility. And because of that, we're confident they'll just show up when they need it. That should smooth the transition.
Right. And when you talk about the tools for liquidity management, you have mentioned forex swaps and bonds. Is there, and do we have an idea of the mix yet? How do we know that you're not doing stealth QE in the market?
Well, I'll come back to the stealth QE comment, but the mix we don't know. I mean, that's something we'll be thinking carefully about in the period ahead. I think a really important consideration, as I kept mentioning, sort of our footprint in markets. Depending on what the demand is, the underlying demand, if we were to satisfy all of that just through open market operation repos, that would imply quite a large footprint potentially in those markets. And that might crowd out private sector repo activity, which we don't want to do. So given that, it might make sense to also underpin the supply with some other tools. FX swaps is one, and you can do that in a way that has minimal interest rate risk. And we used to hold a portfolio of bonds as well, and we could hold some of them in bonds. And as long as they're fairly short dated, they won't impose much interest rate risk on the RBA. So it's sort of balancing that footprint across the different markets and thinking about the risk for the RBA balance sheet itself. So that's something to be determined.
And stealth QE.
Stealth QE. I wouldn't call it stealth QE at all. People never called it that in the past when we did it. I think the big difference here is this is to satisfy an operational need. It's at the very short end of the market. We're not holding it with the intention of trying to influence rates, particularly further out the curve. And there's no sort of big announcement during a period of trauma in the financial system or the economy. So it's holding some bonds. We used to do that. It might be in a slightly higher quantity in the past. That remains to be seen. But it's at the short end of the market, whereas QE is kind of out the curve, trying to influence longer-term rates and expectations about those rates.
Right. Your balance sheet size peaked in March 2022, and since then we have seen $100 billion going away. And then through the rest of this year, we'll see another $100 billion as TFF unwinds and two of your the bonds, the April 2024 and November 2024 bonds mature as well. So is there, do you see, you said that this particular framework does not have implications for monetary policy, but with this $100 billion moving out of the financial system, do you see any monetary policy implications?
No, I mean, it's happening because of an unwinding of the earlier unconventional policies. But I don't think that unwinding, and particularly with this system, will have implications for pressures and rates in money markets and therefore very little to do with financial conditions. The unwinding of the earlier policies, QT itself, is having some effect, some very marginal effect. It's pretty small. I've described in the past that QT, though, is by design about as fun as watching paint dry. So it's designed to have very sort of gentle effects. That's quite different from QE, when markets are under considerable stress, when there's a lot of pressures and banks are coming in, they're making a big announcement to say, we're doing a whole series of things, including this, in order to help calm markets, bring longer rates down. This is just letting the bonds roll off nice and slowly. And that's what's happening here and around the world. And I don't think it's having implications for our financial conditions in a significant manner.
Okay, and sticking with monetary policy, what is, if you have just one word to describe the RBA's current monetary policy stance, what is that one word? Literal tightening, easing, your three options.
I would refuse to answer a question based on such a limitation. Economists can't just use
okay,
one
you
word.
Have more than one word.
The path is uncertain, so maybe uncertain is kind of the key thing. We've sort of said the outlook's uncertain. Inflation's come down, it's moderating. that's a good thing. It's still high, so there's more work to be done. But demand is weakening, and demand and supply are coming into better balance. So that's what you need in order to see a further moderation in inflation. So the central forecasts have that. They also have a further easing in the tightness in labour market conditions. But none of that's certain, and there are things that could move in either direction. And given that, given the interest rate path's uncertain, the board sort of made the point quite pointedly, as Michelle has said many times, the governor, you know, we're not ruling anything in or anything out with regards to rates.
Yeah. Okay, I will open to the floor now. If you have any questions, please raise your hand and identify yourself, full name and company name. Thank you.
Thank you, Swati. Phil O'Donoghue from Deutsche Bank. How are you, Chris? Thanks for that speech this morning. I wanted to ask about active bond sales. Has there been any updates, noting that Deputy Governor now Andrew Howes has been in the role for about 6 weeks? Bank of England, very used to selling bonds. Has Andrew come into the role with perhaps some fresh thinking around bond sales? And has there been any developments on that front?
Nothing that I can refer you to. I mean, we've said that the current approach is let them mature, but periodically come back to consider that case. So when we do, we'll let you know. That's a decision of the whole board, right? And there are a number of different considerations to think about. But again, I think also said this recently, just like the current approach to the bonds maturing is about as interesting as watching the paint dry, active QT, if the board was to pursue it, would be by design about as fun as watching paint dry, but maybe with a window cracked open, right? But not much more fun than that.
Andrew Bohm from iPartners. You mentioned on the graph several times foreign reserves. You noted that the FX market had come under some stress in 2020, and yet it feels like the RBA has not focused at all on intervention in currency markets as going some way to alleviate the pressure on monetary policy and, for that matter, to reduce the amount of liabilities required. It looked to me on the graph that our foreign assets increased during a time of currency stress. Why has the RBA effectively forgotten about the FX market is question one. Question two, if the reason is you don't think you have any control in the FX market, what other than 2020 is our foreign reserves for? Should we just get rid of all of our foreign reserves if we're just saying, you know, the superannuation section buys so much offshore assets every month, we can't do anything about the Aussie dollar being lower than it otherwise could be, hence we are importing inflation? Or lastly, should we just hire some more people in the FX section of the RBA?
I would disagree with your characterisation of the FX market during the pandemic, particularly with regards to the Aussie dollar. It was one market that was actually working relatively well through that period compared to government bond markets, which were not. So we didn't see a need for intervention. There were some pressures elsewhere, and in order that those pressures didn't build, central banks together with the Fed sort of leading the way, provided you the option for US dollar swaps to help alleviate that pressure. So we auctioned off, we provided an auction where banks could bid for US dollars that would have been provided through us, through the Fed. Demand was extremely low, showing there were very limited pressures here, very limited needs for Aussie banks to obtain US dollars. So I would argue the markets at that stage were not under a lot of pressure. But that's not to say it couldn't happen in the future, in which case reserves would be potentially useful to alleviate those sorts of pressures. But I didn't see them at that time.
Can I just have a quick follow-up? I'm not talking about the mechanics of the market. I'm talking about the fact that the RBA appears to no longer consider that foreign exchange intervention, testing and smoothing has any role to play at all, and 100% of the heavy lifting of the RBA is on monetary policy. Why didn't the RBA buy Spot Aussie?
I just disagree with your characterisation. I don't think our purchases or otherwise of Aussie would have affected the level of the Aussie dollar in a way that would allow you to not raise interest rates as much. And indeed, you can sort of look at the Bank of Japan. It's the exchange rates really being dominated by moves in interest rate differentials. And I think that's true of the Australian economy as well. But thank you.
Glenda Corporal from The Australian. Just two questions. If you go back to 2008, I mean, world credit markets were closing and there was a real crisis. Since then, we've got through that. We've got through the pandemic. Do you think that given the sophistication of what central banks, the lessons they've learned, the level of sophistication in policy, that we can be confident that we won't have another sort of world sort of liquidity crisis, perhaps more of the 2008 variety than the 2020? And secondly, if the two board view of the current government goes ahead, how do you think that the new monetary policy board might operate, and could you have a situation where some of the people are very experienced economists and they might have their own very different views on some of the technicalities that you've outlined? It might be a more perhaps interventionist board or a board with a bit more aggressive opinions.
Well, in terms of the lessons, in terms of the lessons, particularly from the GFC, I think you cannot rule out stresses that come from some external source impacting economies and therefore financial markets. I think what's important, though, is what do central banks and other policymakers do in response to that? And very much with the GFC in our mind, when banks were hoarding liquidity back in mid-March 2020 because of the pandemic and the uncertainties, and not just here but globally, we took those lessons from the GFC, and well before the board had convened and made those announcements about the package on the 20th of March, I think it was on the Friday before that, could have been the Thursday, I could be mistaken, we just said, right, we're here to provide liquidity to the banks. They've got plenty of collateral. What they're looking for is liquidity. And we set up these auctions. We increased the amount we were willing to provide. And then the banks all said, we need more than that. And there and then, right there and then, I remember standing next to Guy DeBell in front of the screen saying, right, we're just going to trade right through this. We're just going to provide the banks the liquidity they need. That's how our system's designed. Now, that calmed markets for a few days. Then there was our package. Then there was the government's response and all these other things happening offshore, including what other central banks did. And what you otherwise might have had is a financial crisis a la the GFC. But that was curtailed very quickly. So I think that's the lesson. Do what you need to do. Your job is to provide liquidity to solvent banks with good collateral. Do it. Our system now is pretty much how that's going to be designed. I won't speculate on the Monetary Policy Committee. I mean, it's still in front of Parliament, still to be decided, and we don't know who the members are, so I'll let that one pass through. But thanks for the question, Bernard.
Hi, Jonathan Kearns from Challenger. Chris, taking a longer perspective and injecting a bit of macro into the thinking around this, one consideration, I guess, has been that there's been a long-run decline in the real neutral interest rate, and so therefore there's a greater likelihood that any point in time when you need to cut because of a impending recession, whatever, that you're going to hit the lower bound. And I think that's been seen as a consideration for not going back to a corridor system, because if you hit the lower bound and you have to do QE, then corridor system's going to be ineffective. So better to have a system that's more resilient. So how has the thinking around that been part of the board's consideration, and how do you think the ample reserve system will work when we do at some point hit the lower bound and there's presumably some need for QE or something like that?
Yeah. Well, on the need for QE, I won't say much more than we did that review internally and publish that on QE. And I think the conclusion is that it wouldn't be the first thing you do, but you certainly wouldn't rule it out. I think that's in keeping with actually what happened post-pandemic. It wasn't one of the first things we did, it was one of the later things, because for Australian economy, we didn't think it would be quite as effective. We thought it'd still have some effect, so the board pursued it later in 2020, but they pursued other things first. So I think there are, depending on the circumstances, there are other tools, unconventional if you like. They might have implications for the balance sheet, and I think very much an ample system would be sort of more resilient to that. You'd still say you're in the same system, even under those stresses. You'd just be increasing the supply of reserves. You might want to also increase that supply from other sources, whether it's FX swaps or short-term government bond holdings. You know, that was actually the first thing that started early. We started that also before the March 20 announcement of the package. We started saying these bond markets are dysfunctional. We're going to come in and buy some bonds to alleviate some of those stresses. Again, that would not be consistent with a scarce reserve system. So I think that's part of the thinking. It's a bit more resilient.
Mark McCarthy from the Australian Financial Markets Association. Thanks, Chris, today for your presentation and update. One of your charts showed that the ES balances were drifting down towards around $75 billion by 2028. But I guess given the maturity schedule and interbank activity, it's still possible for those reserves to dwindle down even further. Is the bank targeting a number for ample reserves? Is it sort of between 20 and 50 billion? Is it more than that? What happens when you get down to the scarce reserve situation again?
So we've called it an ample reserve system, and I think that's a helpful name to give it. But the other way of thinking about it, it's really a fixed price system to try and keep control of the key cash rate. And the fixed price system means if you're fixing the price, you're just going to supply whatever is demanded. So we don't know when the banks are going to say, actually, we've had large balances in our accounts. We just didn't need them for our daily payment needs. We didn't need them for our liquidity purposes. At some point, though, when they get low enough, they'll say, ooh, now we might need some. I might need some through next week. I might need some for tomorrow. And they come to our open market operation. So that's the point at which we know we're out of the excess. And it's also the point which stops us getting back to scarce. The banks, you're right, they might get by on they might need them sooner, they might need them later when ES balances are lower, and you sort of picked a number out of the hat. We just don't know where that is. We could have some rough estimates, but banks will learn by doing as well. But the ample reserves, that full allotment auction at fixed price won't allow you to get to a scarce reserves system, almost by definition.
Can I ask one question, Chris? We had inflation data last week. Monthly inflation number came in at 3.4% and has stayed there for 3 months. It was third straight month of 3.4%. It has a 3 in front of you, so is that encouraging, or the fact that it has stayed 3.4% for 3 months, a sign of stickiness and concerning?
Well, our forecasts embed in them this notion that we've had quite a sharp decline in inflation, which is welcome, but then the rest of the distance to get to 2.5 will take some time. So I think it's still broadly consistent with our forecasts. But there's uncertainty around that, and persistence of inflation for various reasons is one risk. But weakness in demand could go the other way, depending on how households' consumption behaves from here, for example. So we think the risks are fairly balanced around that central case, but that the sort of data flow of late doesn't cause me to think that we are sort of off that central path.
Cool. There's one more question there.
Ken Crompton from NAB Market Strategy. You're talking about under the ample reserve system, the ability of using the full allotment system to sort of alleviate short-term scarcity. But you also mentioned the possibility of, you know, changing frequency as needed if there's a greater demand for reserves at some point. Well, I guess possibly there's the possibility of adjusting the term of the repels available as well, maybe. When those changes need to be made, is there any concern that there will be a signalling effect that there is broader stresses present in the system? Or do you sort of perceive that just running an overall ample liquidity system will normalise access to the OMO window enough that there won't be a negative signalling effect? I guess just thinking of some of the efforts the Fed's making to normalise discount window access over there and bring less of a stigma to that. Less of an issue in Australia anyway, but just curious on your thoughts.
Well, I think we've always managed to run a system where the banks feel fairly comfortable coming to our open market operations back when they were daily under the scarce reserve system and then under the full allotment that we've been running for a few years now. So I don't think that's an issue. We don't know what the right frequency should be. It may be more than once a week because you don't know when the pressures that might arise from time to time, either on the demand or the supply side, might come sort of just after the Wednesday that we normally run these things, and then would you wait for another Wednesday? Probably not, depending on how extreme those pressures were. You want private markets to work and move liquidity around as best as you can. That's great. But if the system as a whole was under considerable pressure, you might just schedule some more frequent auctions. I don't think that will be a big deal. Again, that was sort of one of the key points of my speech. This is really about the plumbing. It doesn't signal anything about financial conditions broadly. And indeed, if you're trying to avoid scheduling more frequent auctions to avoid stresses, that's actually going to create the stresses you're trying to avoid. The better thing to do is just do what the market needs. But no one's needed to show up daily. So it's really a waste of everyone's time at the moment with balances where they are, both on the bank's side, on our side. But if we need to change it, we can change it. And we can change it in an instant. You know, it would take not much more than a phone call and a quick decision.
No more questions? Oh, there is.
Hi, Paul Wiley from LSEG. I'm just interested if you've got any comments about the US, where the mandating treasuries repos are being cleared, and is there any thoughts about that in Australia or any read through to here?
So central clearing?
Central clearing.
I know it's something that our staff ponder now and again, particularly in our payments policy, which is responsible for central clearing facilities of substance, and if we had one of those, it would be of substance. But I don't have anything I can sort of say at the moment.
Chris, John Shapiro from the Financial Review. I know we're talking about a lot about financial conditions. I'm just interested in your perspective on global financial conditions. Credit spreads are tight, equity markets are healthy. Is this sort of helping or complicating the RBA's task and that of other central banks? And I guess also mentioning Bank of Japan's decision as well and what effect that might have on financial conditions looking forward.
Yeah. I think, there are definitely measures, and we've talked about these for a little bit of time, including in our recent FSR. There are some easing in some dimensions of financial conditions, strong equity prices, tight credit spreads. Are they, they're worth looking at, they're worth thinking about? Markets can always sort of correct when they're priced quite richly. What does it mean for our financial conditions? Probably not a much, and I don't think it's complicating our decisions. While these are important dimensions of financial conditions, the much more critical ones, the cash rate, the three-month BBSW, the short end of the yield curve, the Aussie dollar. And so what's happening in these markets is something we want to think about, but I don't think it's sort of keeping us up at night. Not much to say about the Bank of Japan and their decision. Wasn't unexpected. think markets are taking in their stride, and you know, the Bank of Japan's in some ways disappointed markets because they were looking for more guidance and they're not getting it. But they'll tell us when they're ready. Thank you.
Okay, we can wrap up today's session. Thank you so much for your time, Chris, and for explaining the new plumbing system to us all.
Yeah.
Ainsley will close the...